welcome to episode 12, the latest episode in the series of podcasts featuring university registrars talking about stuff. This time I'm talking to Dr. David Duncan, Chief Operating Officer and University Secretary at the University of Glasgow, about a range of higher education topics mainly relating to the pandemic. We learn a bit about David's career, the response of Glasgow to the lockdown, and talk about future working arrangements. There's some discussion about the slightly different higher education situation in Scotland, as well as what are going to be challenging arrangements for trying to bring a new normality to campus life in the coming academic year. Financial challenges, international student recruitment and quarantining, the perception of universities in the public realm, and the need to avoid presenting matters as if they were a rapidly approaching apocalypse for universities are also explored. Much to enjoy then. Welcome then to this latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, and it's my real pleasure this time to introduce David Duncan. David is Registrar, COO, can't remember the precise title, at the University of Glasgow. Welcome, David. Perhaps to start off with, you could remind us about your career in higher education and how you ended up at the University of Glasgow.
Well, thank you for having me. So I am Chief Operating Officer and University Secretary at Glasgow, a job I've been doing for just over 3 years. But I've been doing this a similar job at other universities since 2001. So I did a first degree at Aberdeen in history and then a master's and a PhD in Canada, Queen's University. Then I was a postdoc in South Africa. After that, I worked for 9 years for a non-departmental public body working on the school curriculum in Scotland. And then in 2001, I became university secretary at Dundee. 2009, Registrar and Secretary at York, and now I've been at Glasgow since 2017, and that's the sum and substance of my career so far.
Fantastic. So well versed in the ways and many experiences of higher education, but has anything in your career kind of prepared you for the situation that we're currently in? Have you ever seen anything quite like it?
Nothing like it, really. And I don't think the world has really seen anything like it since about, 1918 with the Spanish influenza. Mm. And although I've been around a long time, I'm not that old. it's been a really, really strange time. I suppose you are prepared in a way, though, because what you're used to doing as a university secretary registrar is, first of all, dealing with unusual situations and turning on a sixpence and reacting to new opportunities or risks and challenges. And then secondly, pulling people together. And nothing requires pulling people together like the present crisis, where you've really got to reach out to all parts of the university community and make sure that everybody is pulling in the boat together. So I suppose the natural skills of a university secretary lend itself to this sort of challenge.
Yeah. And I mean, how do you feel your university responded to the challenge? Because it does feel to me that in general, the sector moved, remarkably quickly. We're often lambasted for being slow and not fleet of foot and not very nimble at all and always wanting to bureaucratize and committify everything. But actually, it feels to me we all responded pretty quickly.
I think that's right. I think across the sector, we reacted pretty well and quite swiftly. In fact, I think in some ways we kind of surprised ourselves by how we were able to do things in a few days, sometimes that normally would take 6 months through a whole plethora of committees. So actually, there may be some useful lessons to learn from this for the long term, that actually you don't need to spend forever doing things. You can actually get things done quite quickly.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, I've been hugely impressed with the way that, colleagues across the institution responded. But at the time of recording, the lockdown's been going on for, kind of a couple of months now. And it feels like we have all adapted to what is a very, very different way of working. And it has its own consequences. When you're online in Zoom or Teams meetings or whatever, it is more exhausting than normal face to face. But how do you think it will affect the way that we work in future? I mean, we're not going to return to a position where, in 6 months' time, everyone will be back in the office and it will be as normal, are we?
No, I think that's right. I think we've learned some new skills from this. I mean, for one thing, I mean, even conversations like this, we've learned you don't really need to travel a couple of hundred miles and go and visit somebody to sit down for half an hour with them. You can do it much more efficiently via Zoom or Teams or just over the phone. And, you know, people will also, I think, work more from home in future just because they've got much more used to it. And they found that it doesn't really compromise efficiency to any great extent. Yeah. On the other hand, you know, there are some contrasts as well, aren't there? I mean, I think it's hard to see how hot desking, which you know, a number of people have mooted as the solution to space utilization, improving space utilization rates, is going to be the way forward in a world where you can't share equipment or share a workspace with people. So who knows? I think we'll see once things have settled down in a few months' time. But I think certainly we will have learned new skills and we won't unlearn them quickly.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, particularly for those of us working in professional services, I think it will cause us to rethink the models that we've traditionally assumed would work. But also, as you say, those, concepts of agile working that have been, you know, quite popular of late actually will have to be rethought as well. So it is, I think, a very different model for the future. But I'm sure we'll creatively come up with ways. One of the reasons that we will have to adapt differently, of course, is the fact that we are, you know, across the sector, we are going to be more financially challenged than we've ever been. And, you know, you and I were both students, you know, in the 80s and started working in universities who were still feeling the impact of the, you know, what felt like massive cuts around 15% in 1981, which the sector at that time was completely unprepared for and just didn't see coming. Now, we've got the advantage this time, we can actually see them coming, but we still feel like we're in a pretty dreadful situation. So it's going to be, you know, a world with a lot less resource in it for universities, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. I know our university is modelling next year on a cut in international student numbers of 100%, 50%, 25%, and also a cut in rest of UK students as well. And the effects of that would be devastating, at least in year, they'd be devastating.
Yeah.
A mass reduction in income. Would they have a long-term impact on the university? It depends on how long we go on for. If according to our models, things gradually improve over the subsequent 2 years, then we can ride this out. You know, we won't hit the buffers, but for that year, it's a huge reduction in income, and you have to respond to it by cutting expenditure on everything, really, on staff spend, on consumables, on maintenance, on capital, you name it. And in our case, we'll probably have to borrow money as well, either short term or longer term. So you've really got to rethink the whole fundamentals, at least for that year, and then prepare for some further shocks in subsequent years. Who knows where it's going to go, but it's not going to be pretty. And, you know, different universities are going into it in different situations. Certainly in Scotland, something like 16, 17 out of 19 higher education institutions already have deficits, some of them quite significant deficits, and they're structural, they're long term, they're not things that they can easily work their way out of. And then this comes on top of that. So they're not necessarily going into this crisis in a hale and hearty shape.
So do you, I mean, obviously, again, we've got the, you know, the divergence in national HE sectors that's happened over recent years. And, you know, the responses of, you know, the English and Scottish and Welsh governments has been different towards not just the responses to changing lockdown arrangements, but also to supporting higher education. And I mean, do you think we'll be in a position where, you know, the Scottish government, English government will be looking to direct universities to, you know, to combine, to merge, or they will be letting them close, or, you know, how do you think that's going to play out? Will we see mergers and closures?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. I'm not hearing, at least from the Scottish government so far, a desire to immediately rush to merge institutions. I suspect they've always taken the view that they prefer that institutions made decisions around this themselves. But it may well be that particularly smaller institutions with turnover of only maybe 25 million will just think, well, we just can't survive. You know, we've got a 5 million quid deficit. We've only got a turnover of 25 million. We can't survive on our own. We need a stronger base. And so that in itself may lead to some mergers. I think in Scotland, certainly, we are much more dependent on the state than you are in England. It's just the nature of all home undergraduate teaching being paid for by the state with controls over student numbers and a lower unit of resource than you have in England means that we naturally look to the state to provide rather than necessarily to the market. But you know, it's still a mixed picture in Scotland. We obviously recruit very heavily from rest of UK students who are, you know, can make a choice to come to Glasgow or not. And also obviously international students, particularly in the postgraduate market. So it's a bit of a mixture. What line will the Scottish government take? I don't know. I mean, a few years ago, Alex Salmond, when he was still first minister, was saying that, what was it, the rocks would melt in the sun before we had paid tuition for undergraduate courses. That's fine to say that, but then you can't then turn to the UK government and say, well, you've got to bail us out now because we don't have enough money for our university, which is, of course, what the government is saying at the moment. So I think it's a difficult position. I think the Scottish government's responded very well to it and positively and supportively, but they're strapped for cash too. And so there are no easy solutions.
I'm absolutely right. And it is difficult to see how it will pan out, and there are certainly different messages coming out of different parts of government in England at the moment about what their preferences are there. I mean, I do hope that, given the fundamental importance of universities, which we've never been very good at articulating, I don't think, to the, you know, to the long-term economic success, but also the, you know, the kind of cultural and social success of a nation. You know, we never have been more important than we are now, particularly in terms of obviously finding a vaccine to COVID-19, etc., and the work that universities are doing in response to the challenges of the pandemic. You know, we are absolutely elemental to the future of society in this country, and yet there are still some who doubt the importance of our role and would happily shrink us all down and starve us money because they believe we're still awash with cash. I don't think we've still not done very well in articulating that central importance of universities to the economy and civil society. Do you see any signs of us, you know, being able to get better at it? Are there new approaches you think we should be taking to communicate more effectively or to lobby more effectively? What should we be doing differently, do you think?
Well, it's certainly true that universities have had a rough press the last few years, and it's kind of hard to pin down exactly why that shift happened. Probably to do with the higher fees, more of a market orientation south of the border, and then people questioning, well, what do we get for our money? Are we getting value for money? Which is a reasonable question to get when you're paying fees for your education. But some of the opprobrium that's been dumped on the sector has been completely unreasonable, and some of it perhaps at times has been justified. I think you're right that there will be a slight change in the narrative going forward. I think universities are, as you say, elemental to the success of our economy and our society. I think we're proving that again and again in all sorts of different ways, partly through COVID-related research, through social policy type research, modelling, all that sort of thing, through running testing centres. You know, at Glasgow, we run one of the national testing centres staffed with 800 volunteers from the university plus others. There are all sorts of different ways in which we are important, which our research is important, but also our economic power is important to local communities and local economies. And I think you're right. We have to do more to try to trumpet that. It tends to come across in individual stories about research, new cures for this, that, and the next thing, bits of research that are done, which tend to get reported positively. But the overall story is often quite a negative one. And that negativity comes across from all parts of the media. It's not just the right wing or the left wing press. And it feeds into the consciousness of members of parliament, members of Scottish Parliament and others. I think we've got to work harder at getting across the message that that we have a positive role to play. and that can benefit Britain as it comes out of this this crisis.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And that in order to be in a position to do that, you know, we're like other parts of the economy, and that we need at least some short term support to help us get over it. Because, as you said earlier, international students, which have, you know, effectively propped up UK higher education's economy, have are likely to decrease significantly this autumn, and that will have a profound effect, as you mentioned, on our finances. I mean, I do wonder about this issue about, you know, the way that we portray ourselves, because, you know, the issues around vice chancellor's pay, as you say, about us charging fees and the questions there, but there is a sense in which, you know, no one wants to pay the full price of what this research actually costs. But then, you know, we don't look like we've managed our resources terribly well with our, you know, our pensions disputes, our industrial relations, and we were largely shielded from austerity compared with, you know, most of the public sector and large parts of the private sector. So it looks like we've been comfortably off. So you can understand, I think, that kind of resentment. But it does rather mean that we have to find a way to, you know, both show that we're measuring up, that we're prepared to, you know, to make our share of the savings that, you know, the government expects, and, you know, can come out on this the other side as well, and that we're part of the solution. I just feel that the narrative isn't really coming together for us at the moment.
No, I think that's probably true. We've got to work harder at that. I mean, I think it's true. I mean, if you mentioned a couple of things there, one being the disputes with the campus trade unions, you know, that has become a running sore for years. I mean, in the 19 years I've worked in the sector, again and again and again, we've seen annual pay disputes, disruption to students' education, boycotts of assessment activities, you name it. It really isn't a satisfactory state of affairs, and it's not all the trade union's fault. You know, both sides have got to find a new way forward and really do some fundamental fresh thinking about that relationship. We can't just go on having disruption year after year and expect people to want to roll up and come to study at our universities. And similarly with the pension scheme. I mean, there is a fundamental disagreement about whether that scheme is even in deficit. I mean, of course it's in deficit. Fundamentally, there are serious problems with the pension scheme for academics and related staff meeting its liabilities in the long term. And it's got to be reformed. It's got to be reformed for all our goods, for the staff as well as for the financial well-being of the institutions. And we've got to face up to that in a way that we haven't in the past. We can't keep kicking the can down the road. So I think, you know, some of the criticisms of the sector are valid. Simply rejecting them all and trying to stick our head in the sand and pretend that everything is working perfectly isn't an acceptable response. But we've got to be honest with ourselves, individually as institutions and also collectively.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That kind of denial of some of the realities, not just, you know, the kind of pensions issue you mentioned, but and the perceptions outside the sector of universities, I think is prevalent. But I'm going back to the earlier point. I mean, I do think there's still a lot of denial around about the nature of the financial challenge our sector and individual institutions face. And again, I, you know, reading stuff from the 1981 scenario, you know, people who look back on that say that the, you know, lots of universities just assumed that, you know, a new government would bail out universities as its number one priority, you know, and therefore all institutions needed to do was sit tight and wait for the good knight on a white charger coming over the hill to rescue them with lots and lots of money. And of course that absolutely didn't happen, but lots of universities that didn't respond to the challenge that they were presented with, you know, then suffered, you know, significantly in terms of their ability to respond to it. And it seems to me that I think lots of universities aren't, you know, genuinely engaging with the realities of the situation they face now, but there are plenty of colleagues within institutions who still think that somehow, you know, this doesn't affect them and it will all go away, or somehow, you know, the government will bail everyone out. And it just isn't like that. But it's a very, very difficult message to get across without sounding incredibly alarmist and defeatist.
No, totally. I mean, there were some universities that hit the canvas in the 80s with the cuts, which are only, you know, which are still struggling to get back on their feet, and certainly are not able to compete in the same way that they once were, you know, even 40 years later. But I think presently it is very difficult to get the message across, to get the balance of message right. I mean, there are some universities that have come out and said, look, we're facing a massive black hole, we're staring into the abyss, and they've used apocalyptic language. And I'm not sure that is the right way to go. You want to get across to government and to your own staff the gravity of the situation. But I think if you make it sound like an apocalypse, then people are going to think that it's, you know, there's an inevitability about it. There's nothing they can do about it. And you get some terrible headlines. And, you know, we've seen some of those. And you also set up an argument with your campus trade unions, which is then difficult to walk back from. So, I mean, I don't know. We've been trying to get the message right, to get across the seriousness of the situation, not to scare the pants off people, frankly.
Yeah.
Because we want them to feel positive that they can do something, that we're all in this together, that together we can find ways through this very challenging situation and come out the other side of it.
I absolutely agree, and I think that, you know, we absolutely have to find a, you know, a collective way through it. And you know, if we think forward over the next couple of months as we, you know, gradually try and manage a return to campus, and then some kind of start of session which, if not, you know, normal, is at least partial, and then, you know, next session will be challenging, but, you know, we all want to move to a point where we can get back to the as much in the way of normal teaching and research as possible. But there are so many unanswered questions yet. I mean, I'm sure Glasgow, like Nottingham, is doing a massive amount of planning for the phased return and what the start session will look like. But I mean, it is going to be very different, isn't it? It's going to be very different for first year students, for returning students. Will we have any postgrads actually starting in September, October? And, you know, will we defer many of our postgrad courses to January in the hope of getting international students on them? It's going to all feel very different. I mean, libraries won't be the same, catering outlets, accommodation. You know, the day-to-day existence of campus life will be very, very different for our students and our staff, won't it?
Yes, it will. I mean, it will be a different experience, but there will still be a campus experience. And I think most universities in the UK will coalesce around a similar set of conclusions. One is that, first of all, you have to prioritise health and safety of all members of the university community. That has to be the top priority. But after that, you have to make sure that you offer a quality teaching and learning experience to your students. And that's probably going to involve some form of blended learning, asynchronous teaching off campus, synchronous teaching off campus, and some face-to-face teaching on campus. Otherwise, frankly, why would people bother coming to the UK? If it's all going to be online, you might as well sit in Shanghai or in Paris and do the master's course rather than coming to Nottingham or Glasgow. So I think it has to involve those three elements. But then you have to manage your estate efficiently, to move people around it, to maintain social distancing, to keep people safe, but also to offer them an opportunity to meet with the teachers, and teachers to meet with students and interact in a positive way. And then you have to think about all the other things. You know, how do you get 40,000 people on the campus in and out of the toilet several times a day without bumping into each other? Is a question that I wake up in the middle of the night wondering about that one. And eating, you know, people want to eat at lunchtime at least. And again, you know, a lot of our canteens and cafes are pretty crowded places, but they can't be going forward. We have to find different ways to deliver those sorts of services. And of course, with practical courses that involve lab-based work or other practical work placements and all the rest of it, there are endless complications that have to be worked through. And, you know, your starting assumption is that, you know, a 300-seater lecture theatre, 2 metres distant, you can maybe get 38 people into it. It's not going to be worth giving a lecture in that sort of environment. Or in a lab, which tend to be pretty crowded places at the best of times, especially teaching labs, you're only going to be able to operate at 30% capacity, and you're going to have to give them a good scrubbing between classes. So once you try to factor in just some very practical things like that, it's a lot of work to get it right, but I'm sure we will get it right. The work is underway. We're sharing good practice across the sector. Innovative ideas are being shared. There's a total commitment, I think, to offer an excellent quality student experience to people, to be fair to staff, to keep people safe, and to do the right thing.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there, David. And, you know, we will undoubtedly work our way through it. I mean, it does feel, you know, ferociously complicated. And, you know, no doubt we will learn an awful lot from the experiences of, you know, each other's institutions and adapt accordingly. But it's going to be tough. The final question is about this, coming back to this challenge of international students, because, you know, there is a sense that the outside world has that the UK has really not handled the crisis terribly well compared with other nations. And we are being, you know, publicly criticized for the way we've responded to this, which may or may not be fair, but that's the reality of it. And I think the challenge for us as institution is to present ourselves in a, you know, as a safe environment for international students, as well as our domestic students and our staff. And as you rightly say, health and safety must be the number one concern. But if we are to present ourselves as such, then you know, there's a lot of work to be done. But also, in the event that those students do actually decide that they want to make the journey to the UK, they're persuaded by our ability, there's the non-trivial question of actually getting them here, particularly if there's a quarantine arrangement in place for 2 weeks. And it seems to me there's a huge set of questions about how you actually get someone from, you know, from Shanghai Airport to you know, to your halls in Glasgow or in Nottingham or anywhere else, and then quarantine them for a fortnight, and then enable them to take their full part in campus life thereafter. There's so many questions around that we are going to need to resolve. And the question that I assume many universities will ask is, yeah, is it worth it? I mean, I think it almost absolutely certainly is. But it's another set of almost intractable questions we've got to resolve, isn't it?
Well, totally. I mean, I think if the quarantine thing happens, and it probably will, then we have to think very carefully about how we make that a useful experience for the students who come. And I think the other issues around how people get through airports and on and off public transport, we will resolve, not just as universities, but working with transport authorities and airports and all the rest of it. But I think that quarantine thing is another hurdle that we have to consider and work out how it can be a positive experience rather than feel like, you know, 2 weeks banged up in a cell. Otherwise, people just aren't going to come. Why would they? I think people will still come. That, you know, people are keen to travel. They're also fed up being cooped up in their bedrooms. I know I am for weeks on end. And they want to get out. They want to learn. They want to interact with other human beings. But at the same time, they want to be safe. So I think it's about getting the balance of the offer right, spending a lot of time thinking very carefully about the practical aspects, but also the academic, the learning aspects, and then marrying the two together in something that you can present as a coherent picture. As to why the UK has struggled, and we've had, I don't know, what, 30,000 deaths, and in Australia they had 100. I just don't know. I don't know. I haven't seen the UK authorities in Scotland or in the rest of the UK doing anything dramatically different from other countries. No doubt there are mistakes that every country has made along the way. I just can't work out why there have been so many deaths in the UK. I mean, it's still a tiny, tiny percentage of the total population. And who knows, maybe by the end of the year, when we look at total mortality across the year, it won't look that different from previous years. But, you know, it's a reputational issue that we have to get over. And we have to make sure that as university authorities, working with governments and public health authorities, that we do the right thing going forward.
Absolutely right. And I'm sure we'll get to a position where we, whatever the start session looks like, it will work in some sense, and we'll give the students that we do have, you know, a terrific experience, and one that's safe and secure, and an environment that all our staff who are on campus feel comfortable working in. But David, thank you ever so much for your contributions and for talking about these very challenging and difficult issues. But it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, Paul.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course. And if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.